House Committee on Judiciary come to order. Today is Thursday, March 30th, 2017. We'll open a public hearing on House Bill 2992.
Whitney. Thank you, Chair Barker, members of the committee. House Bill 2992 was brought to us by Representative Noble. House Bill 2992 requires school districts and public charter schools to create a policy requiring criminal record checks of volunteers with direct and unsupervised contact with students. It also allows private schools to adopt this policy. We also got in today a Dash 1 amendment. This adds a section for the schools to have ability to take action before the operative date. And it also amends it to apply only to schools that are allowing volunteers to have direct and unsupervised contact with students. Thank you. We got in an amendment, and I believe it should have been put on OLIS this morning. I'll double check that.
Yeah, it's there.
It's there.
Okay, please go ahead, Representative.
Thank you, Chair Barker, Vice Chair Williamson, and Vice Chair Olson, and members of the committee. Did that yesterday. We are a community, so that's all right. I'm here for House Bill 2992. It's brought to my attention in looking at ORS that the statute allowed school districts to do background checks on volunteers that had direct unsupervised contact with students, but there was no requirement that that occur. And I think that's an important step to ensure that our children are safe in schools, especially around those people who have direct unsupervised contact. I was a coach, a volunteer coach in our school district, and I went through a background check. So I wanted to create a policy or a statute that allowed schools to whoever currently background volunteers not to have to do any work, and it was allow schools that didn't provide their own framework and what worked best for them. So it's very very much just a framework that requires districts to adopt a policy that required background checks for volunteers who had direct unsupervised contact with students, that they'd be backgrounded. I worked with Representative Hernandez to ensure that we had no adverse impact. And the amendment you described actually switches those two things. The first one talked about you shall have a policy that does this. The amendment actually says if you allow volunteers to have direct unsupervised contact, then you must have a policy. So for instance, and I won't talk about what everything that Representative Hernandez is going to speak to, but there are some school districts who do not allow volunteers to have direct unsupervised contact, so they would not need to have a policy. I think this is an important step. It does, to an extent, close a loophole and ensure that we have people who are not a threat to our children working with them in the schools. And with that, I would gladly turn it over.
Chair Barker, Vice Chair Olson, Vice Chair Williamson. For the record, my name is Diego Hernandez, State Representative for House District 47. We worked together to make sure that this policy worked for all districts, and I was interested in it because, one, it improves safety for a whole state, but two, I was also interested in it to have a policy that would work for a school district like mine. I serve on the Reynolds School Board, has a large population of communities of color, but also a population that are undocumented. I wanted to make sure that whatever policies we had didn't exclude those communities from volunteering and still receiving some sort of background check. And so we worked together to make this policy comprehensive in a way that worked for both small, rural, and also large school districts. So this is why I'm supporting House Bill 2992 and urge everyone's support on this.
Okay, thank you. And Representative, did you put your name on the record?
You know, I don't know if I did, but I'm Ron Noble. Okay, I represent the State Representative for House District 24, which is McMinnville up to Hillsborough.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. For your record, Lori Wimmer, representing 44,000 members of the Oregon Education Association, here in support of House Bill 2992 and the Dash 1 amendments. We really appreciate that this bill was brought in a thoughtful way that did its best not to be burdensome to districts, but to keep in mind the necessity of protecting students. I once read that the most likely place for a child to be nabbed was Disneyland. Why? Because that's where the kids are. And so we know that in all enterprises where children are the are plentiful, the folks who might do our kids harm are inclined to look for access points. So we think that this is a common sense way to ensure that our kids are safe. Most districts already have a policy like this in place if they accept the work of volunteers in the schools, but not all. And so we think it makes sense to close that loophole too. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions of anybody? Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay. Close the public hearing on House Bill 2992 and open a work session on House Bill 2616.
Thank you, Chair Barker, members of the committee. If you recall, we held a hearing on this bill on March 1st, 2017. It deals with the waiver of counsel by juveniles in delinquency proceedings. Since the hearing, we have the Dash 2 amendment. The Dash 2 directs courts to appoint counsel for indigent youth in juvenile court if the offense is classified as a crime or as a probationary proceeding and the youth qualifies for court-appointed counsel. It also specifies procedures for a youth to waive counsel. There is no revenue, and the fiscal impact, I have to double check. Apologize. Is a minimal fiscal impact.
Okay. Thank you. Are there any questions? Any discussion? Are there any objections to House Bill 2616?
First, we have to adopt the Dash 2.
Okay, I'm sorry. We'll adopt the Dash 2 amendments are on.
Mr. Chair, I move we adopt the Dash 2 amendments into House Bill 2616.
Representative Williamson moves the Dash 2 amendments into 2616. Do you want to explain those real quick?
Yes, the Dash 2 amendments just added some more specificity as to when the procedures for a youth to waive counsel. Well, first it specifies that a court has to appoint counsel if the youth is qualified for court-appointed counsel. And then second, the procedures for a youth to waive counsel after appointment, such as it requires there to be an initial consultation with the court-appointed counsel before the waiver. And then it specifies that the right to court-appointed counsel also applies in probationary proceedings. And then it provides an exemption for the requirement for court-appointed counsel when it's for like an early disposition program.
Okay. Are there any questions about that for anybody? Okay, the Dash 2s are in. So I guess move it as amended.
Want to move it as yeah. Okay. Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2616 as amended to the floor with a do pass recommendation.
Representative Williamson moves House Bill 2616 as amended to the floor with a do pass recommendation. Are there any objections? Being none, so ordered. And who would like to carry that?
Bill?
Whose
is it?
It's all CDLA's, but it's
I'll carry.
Okay, Representative Williamson will be the carrier. We'll open a public hearing on House Bill 2322.
Chair Barker, Vice Chair Williamson, and Vice Chair Olson. For the record, my name is Dr. Karin Gunson, and I'm your state medical examiner. We have brought House Bill 2322 forward because we think that we need to change the titles that we currently use in our office. Currently, the state medical examiner is the head of the office. Around the nation, around the country, in all municipalities, counties, and state programs, the head of the program is called the chief medical examiner. And we think we need to be brought into line with that norm around the state, around the country. It also causes some confusion because we have so many different titles in my office that involve medical examiners. So we have the state medical examiner, the deputy state medical examiners, the county medical examiners, and deputy medical examiners. So it's a very confusing for the public as well. And that brings up the second change that we'd like to see in the law, and that is to rename deputy medical examiners, who are death scene investigators, and call them by the name that everybody else in the country calls them, which is medical legal death investigators. One of the reasons we want to do this is not only to come into line with what's happening around the country, but also to make it more clear to the public what exactly their role is. The public nowadays often calls them doctor when they come to see them because they think of medical examiners as being physicians. So this would remove any non-physician from carrying the title of medical examiner.
Did you want to clarify anything?
No, Chair Barker. Members of the committee, we have received the revenue impact, but we haven't received the fiscal, so we're not ready to move it today.
Okay. Representative Springer, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Doctor, can you just briefly explain to us what a deputy medical examiner is and the capacity of that role and the authorities that they do have and don't have?
Chair Barker, Representative Springer, the deputy state medical examiner is essentially a death scene investigator. They are lay investigators who are like our detectives, if you will, our medical detectives. In the more populous or urban counties, they are full-time investigators who are board certified by the American Board of Medical Legal Death Investigators. Their duty is to act as the eyes and ears of the medical examiner, either the state or deputy state medical examiner at the scene. So they will examine briefly, they'll examine the body, they'll examine the scene. They write a report for us. They do things like collect medications that are present at the scene, count those pills. And most, very importantly, they also are the people who do the background investigation and help identify next of kin and notify next of kin in deaths.
Please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for that answer. So has that role changed a little bit over the last 20-ish years? And certainly there's a different role played by rural counties and more urban areas. I was a deputy medical examiner way over in Grant County, and the only reason I was is we needed somebody to ride the horse up to where we found dead bodies that could release the body under certain circumstances. So what you described sounds a little different than that.
Chair Barker, Representative Springer, it has evolved. Our system has not as evolved as fast as I would like it, but there is a lot more responsibility for those people to protect the welfare of the body itself, also to protect the scene, and to make sure that the evidence is gathered that helps us determine the cause and manner of death. And also, there's a lot more responsibility as far as notifying next of kin. And sometimes those searches can take a long time and involve many hours, obviously. So I do think that over the years, since this law was first enacted, there's been a great change in the role of a death investigator.
Good. Yeah, thank you. So we're unable to move that, so I'm going to close that. I'm going to have the committee stand at ease for about 5 minutes. We're expecting. Call the House Committee on Judiciary back to order, and we'll call open a public hearing on House Bill 2355. If you want to give us a rundown, and we'll call Dr. Gunson and Representative Benz, please.
Do you mean
2472? I mean 2472. Fingers on the wrong line here. Dyslexia strikes again.
Chair Barker, members of the committee, House Bill 2472 requires the state medical examiner to assume responsibility for all deaths requiring an investigation by July 2021. House Bill 2472 allows the state to assume responsibility for some regions before then. There is an emergency clause attached, and there are no amendments, but we do not have the fiscal statement.
Okay. Okay, please, Doctor or Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For Cliff Benz, State Representative, District 60. Thank you so much for hearing this bill. I was asked by Dr. Tom Fitzpatrick, physician in Burns, to bring this bill. The reasons for it will become apparent as Dr. Gunson goes through the current situation. I will just say it wasn't apparent to me the necessity of the high level of analysis necessary in situations involving a coroner, and the result without appropriate assistance is that people who commit crimes can sometimes escape with a murder in these rural parts of the state, and that's just not right. And so I'm hopeful that something can be done. There's quite a cost that goes with this, and I appreciate the challenges we have with our budget. But at least this bill brings this matter to all of the state's attention. It's worthy of your consideration, and thank you again for hearing the bill.
Thank you, Doctor.
Once again, for the record, my name is Dr. Karen Gunson. I'm the state medical examiner. House Bill 2472 would restructure the state medical examiner's office. And also, for the record, OSP and the medical examiner's office is neutral on this particular bill. I just want to give you some background information. It first came up in 2012 when then-Governor Kitzhaber asked the state medical examiner's office to give him a plan for regionalization of the medical examiner services. And this was in response to the dire needs of some of the counties in Southern Oregon. And we came up with a plan that would regionalize the medical examiner's office, and also during that regionalization would take control or take the opportunity to provide all the death scene investigation as well. Currently, the law is such that the state medical examiner provides all the forensic pathology services, including autopsy, toxicology, and court testimony. And we do that with six forensic pathologists, four in the Clackamas County area, one in Lane County, and one in Southern Oregon. And all of the death scene investigation, as we spoke about before, is handled on a local level by the counties. So while the state medical examiner's office has the responsibility of making sure this system works properly, I have no authority over how each county carries out their death scene investigation. They are required to report to our office within 5 days, but many times those reports are weeks, if not sometimes months, coming to us. So we may not be able to give advice to the local county medical examiner if they're not timely in their reporting. One of the benefits that this bill would bring forward is a consistency and professional approach to all death scene investigations around the state, as forensic pathologists would then be conducting those examinations along with their medical legal death investigators. In many of the counties, rural counties, the death scene investigators are sheriff's officers who do this in addition to their law enforcement duties, and many of them will only see two or three or four death scenes a year, so not really having the experience to handle those death scenes as they come across them as a medical examiner would. In the populous or urban counties, we have full-time death investigators who are board certified by the American Board of Medical Legal Death Investigators. They see maybe two or three scenes a day and work those scenes as a police officer would because they're an expert at it. So there is a marked lack of consistency depending on which county you're in as to how a death scene is investigated. So this bill would provide consistent and professional death investigation for all of the counties, rural and urban. So the reports would come in a timely fashion. Our fear is that we are missing such things as drug overdoses, suicides, and maybe even homicides from what we have seen around the state. Some of the counties we don't even get a report from because they have no deputy medical examiners because of their dire fiscal condition. Such as Josephine and Curry counties. The drawbacks for this would be the expense, as was already alluded to. Right now, my budget for a biennia is just over $5 million. That covers the six forensic pathologists and our ancillary people, such as medical transcriptionists and an administrator, so 11 people. And this would greatly expand the state medical examiner's office. Obviously, we would have to hire death scene investigators, provide infrastructure, trucks, and so forth. So it would go from $5 million a biennium, probably up to about $16 million a biennium, an additional $11.5 million, obviously a chunk of change for that change. It would have to be phased in over two biennium because it would be a complicated step-by-step fashion where we would bring one region in and then another region over time. And we would have to change more portions of the law as well in order to be able to do that. And you really are not going to be able to run two systems at once. So once you get started on it, you probably have to really go to the end to create the system. So there would have to be a will over a couple of biennia to do that.
Okay. Any questions? Representative Vile.
Does your plan include a vision to make sure that in those areas where you don't really need full-time coverage, that you've got shared coverage across jurisdictions?
Representative Barker and Representative Vile, yes, that's the whole key to it, is that we would have several counties in a region and that those counties would share a full-time death investigator. And since it would be part of Oregon State Police, there are many offices located around, especially in the rural areas, where, say, a death scene investigator could go and park themselves and write a report and then go out, never really having to come back to the hub or the regional center. So they would cover many counties.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Any further? Okay, thank you very much. Appreciate your testimony. And we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2472. And we'll switch horses here. It's like the Pony Express. We'll open a public hearing on House Bill 2625 from yesterday and call Mary Sell, please.
Hello, Chair Barker, members of the committee. My name is Mary Sell. I'm here on behalf of the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association. Thank you so much for allowing me to come back and take a little bit of time to go ahead and put our OCDLA's positions on the record on two bills. The first is House Bill 3283. This is the Animal Neglect Prohibition of Possessing Animals Bill. We're neutral on this bill, but we did want to suggest injecting some judicial discretion into the statute. The first piece of this, from a policy standpoint, neglect is different from intentional abuse. We do propose, as far as Animal Neglect 1 and Animal Neglect 2 go, we would like for the court to have some discretion in the imposition of the 5 years. And so instead of imposing the 5-year prohibition, we would like the court to retain discretion to essentially impose up to 5 years. We have that same thought as to the felonies. And so the way that this bill is currently written, it would have the court impose essentially a mandatory 15 years. And so what we're asking would be for the judge to retain discretion to impose up to 15 years. We just believe that the court will be able to make a case-by-case basis and actually look at the situation. One thing that's important for us to note for the committee is that most of our clients who end up being charged with these types of crimes, as you heard from many people yesterday from the Oregon Humane Society, a lot of times these people have mental illnesses. And so with the right kind of treatment and help, it would be possible that owning animals would not be should not be blanket prohibited, and instead we would request some discretion be left into the statute. The next bill is 2637. OCDLA does oppose this bill. This, if we recall, there were a lot of questions yesterday. We had testimony from ranchers, and we had testimony, I believe, from farmers, and there were a lot of people who were really concerned about this bill being broad. I sat through the entire hearing, and I think I'm kind of in a an interesting spot because while I was sitting listening, I formulated a few ideas I would be willing to share with the committee on how possibly this bill could get closer to what the proponents seem to be intending. A lot of the testimony we heard yesterday had to do with what really ultimately ended up being intentional or knowing acts, but the real issue was the lack of physical injury. So when in criminal law, when we deal with physical injury, we're usually talking about assault. When we're dealing with something that's criminal in nature that has no physical injury, we're dealing with something like harassment. This case or this bill is really interesting because the way that it's formulated, it's very similar to a crime called reckless endangering of another person. That's a relatively serious Class A misdemeanor. The way that reckless endangering is broken down, essentially a person commits the crime, and actually I want to make sure that I'm outlining this correctly for you. So a person commits the crime of recklessly endangering another person if the person recklessly engages in conduct which creates a substantial risk of serious physical injury. The bill in front of you it mirrors that language, but it actually uses some different terms, and the different terms end up mattering a good amount. And so the bill in front of you says a person commits the crime of animal abuse in the third degree if, except as otherwise authorized by law, the person intentionally, knowing, or recklessly engages in conduct that creates a substantial risk of physical injury. And so here, it's got multiple mental states, and I'm going to come back to the mental states in a moment, but it also says creates a substantial risk of physical injury. Reckless endangering of another person would be substantial or serious physical injury. There are differences in the law between what physical injury is and what serious physical injury is. Reckless endangering of another person is more serious because of, in part, because of the level of physical injury. So yesterday you heard testimony from stakeholders who were concerned about the broad application of this statute. I agree, and OCDLA agrees, that there could be unintended acts that are brought in under the statute because we're dealing with not actual physical injury, but the risk of physical injury. And we're not dealing with an intentional mental state, which means I intend the consequence of my actions, or a knowing mental state, which means I know that, or I have knowledge that my act or omission is going to create some kind of result. This is reckless. What reckless is essentially I'm aware of a risk and I disregard that. And so that mental state is one of the lower mental states. So we have intentionally, we've got knowingly, we've got recklessly, and then we've got criminal negligence. So reckless ultimately is an easier mental state to prove, but it is broad, it has a broader application. So some of the examples that my legislative committee came up with, and we do believe are the types of conduct that could come underneath the statute if it remains as written, would essentially possibly unintentionally criminalize people for doing what a lot of us do on a daily basis. So taking a walk with our dog off leash on a trail. There's a risk that they could run ahead and fall off into a ravine. There's a risk of that for humans. But many people every day, non-criminal people, take their dogs off leash on trail. Driving a car with your dog sitting in the back. So a lot of people will have essentially open up the trunk, have the dog jump in. They're not strapped in. They're in kind of an enclosed area, but they're not strapped in. So if you slam the brakes on, there's a risk. There's a foreseeable risk that if you slam the brakes on, your dog is going to hit the side of the car and is going to be injured. There's a possibility of that happening. And this was brought up by Representative Springer yesterday. What if your dog lives outside? Yesterday when I was walking back to my car after this hearing, I laughed because I saw a woman pushing a small dog in a carriage meant for an animal. Some people do not treat their dogs like children. I'm not embarrassed to admit that I do. I call my dog my dog-der, which I think is clever. I do. But many people don't. My parents don't. Other respected members of the community do not. And so if you think about your large dog who's living in, you know, one of those little igloos in your garage and it's cold at night, there's a potential there. Or if you're like me, you have way too many Christmas ornament boxes and those are stacked precariously and your dog gets excited and its big tail hits the thing and the box falls on top of the dog. So these situations can be really innocuous. These are non-criminal. These are good people who love their pets. And so I understand, and OCDLA understands, the desire to protect the vulnerable, and we do believe that animals can be vulnerable. But in a situation like this, when this legislative body is creating law, we want it to be as finely tuned as possible to actually get at the instances that we're worried about. So I'm going to end my testimony in just a moment, but what I think we can do is step back from the way that this language is modeled and possibly look at modeling it at an existing law where you've got intentional or knowing action or mental state with no physical injury. Instead of saying that there could be a risk that physical injury could happen, let's go with law that exists already and makes more sense that it's not going to accidentally capture these instances, such as the examples brought up by my legislative committee. So thank you for the ability to testify today. I know that you've got a lot of other things on the docket, and so I'll go ahead and end now unless there are questions I can answer.
Questions, Representative Bile.
Chair Barker, Mary, I just want to make sure I'm clear. Is it your position that recklessly could capture someone who is walking their dog off leash on a trail?
That would be my perspective. And so the legal definition of recklessly would be a person that, Chair Barker, Representative Vile, I'm trying to be fast.
Please.
So recklessly, a person acts recklessly if that person is aware of and consciously disregards a substantial and unjustifiable risk that a particular result will occur or circumstances exist. The risk must be of such nature and degree that disregarding it constitutes a gross deviation from the standard of care that a reasonable person would observe in the situation. And so when we're talking about the reasonable person, we're talking about kind of this fake, non-existent person. Would a reasonable person walk their dog along a really narrow switchback without a leash? I would say a lot of people would. Some people might not. And the concern that we have is not only is this law written in a way that is constructed in a way that it's criminalizing possible result, we do believe that recklessly, when we're talking about this type of crime, doesn't make sense. We do believe it's too broad.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
And I actually have one other thought. And it's regarding the construction. Let me just look at my note really quick. So going back to the idea of this being modeled after reckless endangering of another person, there is case law for that specific charge that the Court of Appeals over and over again says that statute prohibiting recklessly endangering another person applies to conduct that is likely to expose another person to harm and is not limited to conduct that actually exposes another person to harm. And so it only has to likely expose someone to harm. It doesn't actually... it's not limited to something that actually exposes another person to harm. So just the potential that your Christmas tree box could fall on your dog could technically fall under this. And so my testimony is it needs to be pulled in.
Thank you, Representative Williamson.
So I want to make sure I'm clear on this, Mary, because I think I know. I think I know the answer to this. But so ORS 163.160 assault of a person in the fourth degree requires a physical injury.
That's correct.
So this bill, mm-hmm. assault of an animal, would not require physical injury.
Chair Barker, Representative Williamson, so the way that this animal abuse in the third degree is written, it's not requiring physical injury. It's only requiring that there's a substantial risk of physical injury or exposing the animal to risk of physical injury. And so it's not requiring physical injury at all. So it's not actually... it's not actually equatable to assault.
Right. That was my next question, is whether or not then we had a statute for animals that required
injury, lack of a better term, than an assault on a person.
Would you rephrase that?
So proving assault of a person required a physical injury, mm-hmm. not of an animal. So they're not parallel statutes.
That's Chair Barker, Representative Williamson. I think your point's well taken. What I'm understanding you to say is we're actually protecting that this statute actually is kind of has a broader application in protecting animals more than we protect humans, possibly.
I think that's what I'm getting at, not very articulately.
And I'm not
and not in a judgy sort of way.
Right.
I'm just trying to figure out if we're
protect your dog.
Yeah, her dogder.
My dogder, yes.
Yeah, just that we're putting it in a different crime. I mean, because harassment is the equivalent without a physical injury, right?
That's right. And so Chair Barker, Representative Williamson, or Vice Chair Williamson, my understanding of the assault laws obviously it requires a physical injury. In the case of harassment, that would be subjecting intentionally, the mental state being with an intent, intentionally subjecting another person to offensive physical contact, but it doesn't require injury. This statute is modeled after reckless endangering of another person, which it just doesn't make sense to us from a legal perspective.
Okay, thank you. Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you. I appreciate you allowing me to come today to give my testimony.
And I'll announce that House Bill 2355, which is being called the profiling bill, the paperwork was posted at 1:43, and we have to wait 1 hour before we can hear that bill, so we won't be able to hear that until 2:43. We'll open a work session on House Bill 2955.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2955 elevates the crime of strangulation from a Class A misdemeanor to a Class C felony when the victim is a family or household member. The bill also includes knowingly impeding the normal breathing or circulation of blood through the application of pressure to the chest as a means by which the crime may be committed. House Bill 2955 has no revenue impact and a fiscal impact. So we need to move that down to the Ways and Means Committee.
We heard that bill. Are there any discussion about that bill?
Mr. Chair,
yes. Representative Greenlee.
I really have a great reluctance to create new crimes, new versions for crimes. I usually put on a restriction in my mind as I consider it, the extent to which the new approach might serve as a deterrent to any further actions in this case. Seems to me in this case it does have the potential for acting as a deterrent, and I'm happy to support the bill.
Thank you for your remarks, Representative. Anything further? Are there any objections to the bill?
We need a motion.
Motion, okay.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2955 to the floor with the due pass recommendation and with prior referral to Ways and Means.
Representative Williamson moves House Bill 2955 with the due pass recommendation to the floor with prior referral to Ways and Means. Is there any discussion?
Or subsequent referral.
Subsequent referral, whatever.
Prior
it
wasn't right.
It's going to Ways and Means.
Going to Ways and Means.
If it passes. Are there any objections to the bill? Seeing none so ordered, bill goes to Ways and Means. Open a public hearing on House Bill.
Work
session on House Bill 2972.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2972 prohibits universities and colleges from threatening discipline or other sanctions to influence the decision of a victim of an alleged sexual assault, domestic violence, or stalking from reporting the incident or participate in the investigation or adjudication of the incident. There's also a -1 amendment before you today that prohibits the actual imposition of sanctions in these same circumstances. And with the -1 amendment, House Bill 2972 has no revenue impact and no fiscal impact.
Mr. Chair, I move the -1 amendments into House Bill 2972.
Representative Williams moves the -1 amendments into House Bill 2972. Is there any discussion?
Question. Just help me with my legalese, maybe, because I just read this morning on the -1 amendment. Perhaps you need to help me with the word imposition. So what is the desire of changing that language? What is it going to mean?
Mr. Chair, Representative Post, when you heard the bill last week, I think the bill prohibits the threat of sanctions to achieve a result. A question was raised by your esteemed colleague about when we move past threats into actually imposing sanctions to influence the same result. So the additional word just means whether it's the threat or the actual sanction.
By the school.
Correct.
Got it. That's what I thought, but I just want to make sure.
And as we've learned many times, we have to be very precise in language of these, or they fail the first time out.
Yeah.
Is there any discussion, any more discussion about the amendment? Okay. Representative Williamson has moved the dash one amendments into House Bill 2972. Are there any objections? Seeing none, so ordered.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2972 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Williamson moves House Bill 2972 as amended to the floor with the due pass recommendation. Once again, any discussion? Are there any objections? Seeing none, so ordered. Is that your bill? And we'll have Representative Leininger be the carrier, please.
Thanks.
Open a work session on House Bill 2988.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2988 classifies the crime of harassment involving offensive physical contact as a Class A misdemeanor and a person crime when it's committed in the presence of a minor child or stepchild of or a minor child residing with the defendant or victim. House Bill 2988 has no revenue impact and a minimal fiscal impact.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2988 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Williamson moves House Bill 2988 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Are there any objections? Seeing none, so ordered. Representative Garcia Carrier, please. Okay, and so since we have to wait until 2:43, I'm going to have the committee stand at ease until.
Wait, we've got one on the back.
What's that?
Can we move my bill on the back? Turn it over.
Yeah.
Don't kill my bill. Why are you killing my bill?
I'm lying.
We got one more, buddy.
3176.
Yeah. Yeah, we'll let that one go. Open a work session on House Bill 3176.
Mr. Chair, go ahead. No, I'm all anxious now.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 3176 authorizes the court when imposing a sentence to consider whether the defendant committed a crime while being commanded or urged by or under pressure or influence from a person who has committed domestic violence against the defendant. There is a dash 3 amendment before you today that includes causing the defendant to engage in a commercial sex act as well as the domestic violence provisions. With the dash 3 amendment, House Bill 3176 has no revenue impact and a minimal fiscal impact.
All right, Mr. Chair, I move the dash 3 amendments into House Bill 3176.
Representative Williams moves the dash 3 amendments off of page 2 into House Bill 3176. Is there any discussion? Any objections? Seeing none, so ordered.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 3176 as amended to the floor with the due pass recommendation.
Representative Williams moves House Bill 3176 as amended to the floor with the due pass recommendation. Again, is there any discussion? Are there any objections? Seeing none, so ordered. And Representative Williamson, if you'd carry that first, please.
Carrying my bill, thank you.
Now we will stand at ease until 2:45.
Dash 13 and dash 12.
The House Judiciary Committee reconvene, and we will open a work session on House Bill 2355. Mr. Espy, please.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2355 with the dash 13 amendments modifies the circumstances under which possession of a controlled substance is classified as a felony. In the amendments, the possession is a felony if the defendant possesses a usable quantity and one of four factors are present. The defendant has a prior felony conviction of any kind. The defendant has two or more prior convictions for possessing a usable quantity of a controlled substance. The offense is a commercial drug offense, or the possession exceeds an amount specified in the bill. The dash 13 amendment applies earned discharge to misdemeanor possession crimes and requires that the misdemeanor offenses be prosecuted in circuit court. Directs the Oregon Criminal Justice Commission to study the effect of misdemeanor offenses on the criminal justice system, rates of recidivism, and the composition of the population of persons convicted of a felony. The amendments also reduce the maximum length of a Class A misdemeanor offense to 364 days. With the dash 13 amendments, House Bill 2355 has no revenue impact, and we do have a fiscal light, so the bill is ready to move to Ways and Means.
Thank you. Representative Olson.
Yeah, I have a comment. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I I get where this House bill is. It's driven from a group of people that have done an outstanding job, as far as I'm concerned, over the last 18 months off of the task force of House Bill 2005 from 2015. I really appreciate all their efforts and work on this. I do have some concerns with the bill itself. My first concern deals with funding. You and I have talked about this. I'll be truthful with you, I'm going to be a no coming out of here right now, going down to Ways and Means, but I could very easily change that depending on what happens out of Ways and Means and the support of this bill from that. I have the concerns toward funding the community corrections. I have concerns toward the Justice Reinvestment Initiative, how that's all going to play back out. Many of us, we also have serious concern with the treatment that's going to be available from the misdemeanor side of all issues. Now, I clearly understand the data collection piece of it. I don't have a problem with that, but let's face it, from my perspective, this is a Portland problem. This is not an issue that I'm experiencing down in Linn County. Talking with the sheriff down there, Bruce Riley, he shared that a former sheriff back in the 90s had implemented data collection so that they could constantly be reflecting on what is happening. And they have not seen the issues involved, but they continue to practice the data collection. The same thing with John Sassman over there in Corvallis Police Department. And I just want to read it, just a small little piece of a text message that John sent to me this morning in response to my questions on that. He said that we are in our demographic, and report says this: the patterns and the findings across each of the 8 methodologies do not indicate the presence of racial, ethnic bias and stops and search outcomes for the Corvallis Police Department. The result is no for each of the 8 tests. So, they continue, though, to collect data because that's just the nature of their agency. But I just want you to know that there are agencies out there that are doing this. They're really concerned about this issue. I think if it hadn't been for some of the issues that happened up north, we may not be here where we're at today.
Okay, thank you. And I'd like to go ahead and move the amendment first, then we'll have discussion.
Okay. Mr. Chair, I move the -13 amendment into House Bill 2355.
Representative Williamson moves the -13 amendments into House Bill 2355. Call the roll, please.
Representative Forsyth?
Wait. Yes.
For the amendment?
For the amendment.
Representative Greenlee?
Yes.
Representative Leininger?
Yes.
No.
Representative Sanchez?
Yes.
Representative Springer?
Yes.
Representative Stark?
Excused.
Representative Vial?
Yes.
Vice Chair Olson?
No.
Vice Chair Williamson?
Yes.
Chair Barker?
Yes. The amendments are in.
Can I make a comment?
Yeah, and then
it'll be quick.
We can move the bill and then do the comments. Whichever you want to do.
Oh, I'll make the comments first, because okay. I want to agree with my colleague from Albany in thanking the folks who worked very, very hard on this bill. There's been a lot of work done, and House Bill 2005 in the last session was my bill, and so I'm so proud to work with the Attorney General on moving this forward. And I'd like to thank the law enforcement agencies like the folks that the representative from Albany was just talking about who are collecting data, because I think it's incredibly important for where we are right now in our country and legitimacy of law enforcement. And so the more data we can have, I think the better our policing system is. So I'm hoping that we can get to that point where I don't believe it's just a Portland problem. I think there are other agencies that could benefit from collecting data. And I think as a state, we benefit statewide when we collect data and we can actually see what's going on, so it's not, we're not getting into arguments that are not data driven around what's happening in our communities. And for the second part of the bill, I am incredibly pleased to work towards decriminalizing addiction. Addiction is a healthcare issue that we've treated as a criminal issue for far too long in this country. And to allow people to get that healthcare that they need and get their lives back in order, and to not have permanent records that keep them from jobs and housing and school loans and all of the things that can disadvantage you for the rest of your life because you were suffering with addiction, I think this is a really important first step in helping to balance our public safety system with our healthcare system and dealing with what is a healthcare crisis across this state in every community. This is an important move to helping Oregonians who are struggling with addiction.
Thank you. Representative Springer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think the last time a vote was this hard for me was in 2009, and it was a school closure bill. I don't like this bill, and I'll tell you why I don't like this bill, and I'm going to vote yes. I don't like this, and I'm offended at times by the tone of the conversation and where the conversation comes from oftentimes. It wasn't, let's see if there's profiling. It was, there's profiling, and let's get the cops and the departments that do it. And there was a punitive portion that initially was talked about in this bill. And that's not the case. That's not the case. I'm not saying it's never the case, but I've said it 100 times. Nobody has more contempt for a bad cop than a good cop. It's just a fact. So I've had such anxiety over this bill because of that. Now, that said, I have two sheriffs, parts of two counties. I have two sheriffs. Jason Myers has worked his butt off on this bill amongst many other people. And I can't turn a blind eye to that. He worked incredibly hard. And there were others, but he's one of my two sheriffs. He's one of my two sheriffs. The other thing is, I hope, and I'm going to say this very loudly and clearly, I hope that when we look at the data that's collected here, that we respect the data that's collected here. Let me say that again. I want us to respect the data that's collected. If we have data that indicates a problem, jump on it like nobody's business. But if we have data that does not prove the premise in certain departments, then I want that acknowledged too. And I won't have much tolerance for, well, we didn't like the process. So I want us to look at that. One of the things we learned looking at Corvallis, and they've been doing data collection for years, there were signs, there was data that would lead to the conclusion there was profiling by the police. If we want to get down into the data was profiling by the people calling the calls in to the police, and the police have to respond. So I ask all the proponents of this bill and opponents to take the data, parse the data out, and then pay attention to what the data says. And maybe the data will say, we don't have a problem here, and then let's honor that. And maybe we do or we don't here, and let's respond to that. And I have to give kudos to cops are not very good at changing. They're just not. And they sat down at the table and they wrestled with a hard issue that they didn't feel they deserved. And I want to honor their work. On the drug piece, I'm going to be yes here today. I have no idea what I'll be on the floor. And it might depend on the mood that day. My concern is we've set up a great system, maybe. If we agree this is a great system, if it doesn't get funded in ways and means, it's going to fail. So we can't pass it here, expect it to go to ways and means and not be funded and work. It has got to be funded. And certainly the profiling piece that gives more money to DPSSD to train for this has to be funded also. I'm done.
Thank you. Representative Post.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. First, I want to say I agree with everything pretty much that our Vice Chair Williamson and Vice Chair Olson said, all of your points. The two things I want to explain of why I would be a no on this bill. One, it's partly the procedure of this building, of which I'm now in my second term and third session. And I don't like the procedures of this building, and this is a perfect example. A day or so ago, we had an issue on the floor where there was an amendment in the case of a minority report, and it was talked about how sudden it was and how we didn't have time to vet it or digest it or discuss it in committee, and I understand that, and I feel the same way with this. A dash 13 amendment that was put up here an hour ago. Okay, so I had 45 minutes. I went down to my office and I read it, but I'm sorry, I'm a little slower than some people, and I couldn't digest 20 pages in the last 45 minutes and completely understand what it said. So that bothers me. I'd like to have a week, please, to discuss this some more and to think about it some more. The process is broken. I can't stand the process in this building, and this is one of the examples of that. The second one is from day one, this bill has been two bills in one. I liken it to the budget bills that we get at the end of the session where we have 17 budgets in one bill. We should have 17 budget bills, not one bill. This is two different topics that have nothing to do with each other. Oh, I suppose you could find a thin string somewhere and tie them together, but it's two separate, very important topics that should be discussed and should be talked about in two different bills. This was first brought to me, I think, early in the session, or maybe perhaps it was back in one of our legislative days, as a way to address some drug violations and to perhaps exactly what Vice Chair Williamson talked about, perhaps help some people who are in this loop that is so bad. Nobody talked to me about a racial profiling bill. They said, we have this bill coming that's going to take care of some drug issues. And I said, I like it. I want to hear more about it. And then it became a racial profiling bill with some drugs left in it. And I have a hard time. So maybe it's because I've not fully digested it, but it's two different bills. Let's take some time, separate them out, make two bills, and let's come back and vote on those two bills. And I know it's too late for that, but that's why I'm a no. And I thank you for indulging me.
Representative Leininger.
Thank you so much, Chair Barker. I want to thank the community members who are participants in this work group process, and the sheriffs and chiefs of police and ACLU and Unite Oregon and the Attorney General's Office and the criminal defense lawyers and probably CAUSA also. I see some reps have come in. So many people did brave work in support of developing this bill that has important elements that I support. And I also want to affirm and just recognize the brave comments by my colleague here, the representative from places that include SIO and other places too.
SIO plus 10 of us.
I think that was a really authentic, heartfelt comment about the fact that there are a lot of good law enforcement officials out there, and it pains the good people on all parts of this issue when something bad happens. And I just want to acknowledge that I hear you, and I agree that that's an important theme that needs to not get lost in this work. And so with that.
Representative Bush.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I like everything that's been said, even Andy Olson. I mean, yeah. Unfortunately, we are where we are. I certainly understand what you're saying, Representative Post. It does feel like two bills to me as well. But that said, I think the most important part of this is, as has been expressed already, so I won't belabor this, but the idea here is not to get the police. The idea here is to get good data so that we then have a decent leg to stand on when people say cops aren't fair, cops profile. We will actually have data where we can say whether that's correct or not. That's been a problem across the country when we talk about deadly force, the same sort of thing. So I think that this can help, and so that's why I'm supporting it. Thank you, Mr.
Thank
Chair.
Thank you. Anybody else? Representative Bile.
I feel every day at a significant loss having not been around the criminal law environment for the past 35 years, and this one particularly taxed my concern about wanting to do the right thing. I'm reluctantly going to vote yes based on the dash 13 amendments, but I really do have a concern about whether it really is a cost-neutral bill. I just sense that if we don't get the money for treatment that we really need. And it's got to be new money. It can't be just trading dollars around. In researching this, California and Utah, when they did this, actually experienced a spike in criminal activity. And until they really got after the treatment part of the program, they didn't solve the problem. And so I hope that we don't ignore that as we go forward. But I represent a district that has jurisdictions that I don't believe we've got profiling problems, but I too, like Representative Springer, am anxious that we have data that helps us appreciate the fact that we really do have folks that are acting appropriately. Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. Okay, and I'll just say I want to thank the Attorney General's office, and especially Aaron Knott, for all the work he's done on this bill and everybody else that's worked for the past 18 months on this bill. Mm-hmm. There is a national tension between law enforcement and the communities. And the only way we can find out is by gathering data what that problem is or isn't. And I agree that we should also look at the good and not just try to single out things that turn out to be to show that things are bad. But without collecting the data, we can't. It'll just be I think this and I think that, or I believe this or believe that, and that doesn't work. So we need the actual statistics, and it's been very helpful for the people who brought that in. I want to give another special thanks to Speaker Kotek, to Mr. Campbell, who represents the sheriffs and chiefs, for working very hard to bring in the drug piece of this together. It was very hard to get there. People bent over, the law enforcement community, I believe, bent over way over backwards, and the speaker did the same thing coming back to get that number secured for today. The money is vital. That's one of the reasons I wanted to get this bill out today and not wait another day. We've got to get it down and start trying to find the cash to support this program. And it is about we're trying to not felonize addicts, but get them help if we can. If we can't, they may end up being a felon, but it hasn't worked. The war on drugs has failed. It's failed everywhere. And so this, I hope, is a step in the right direction. And therefore, I'm hoping to move the bill today. So if we could.
So, Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2355, as amended with a due pass recommendation with a subsequent referral to Ways and Means.
Representative Williamson moves House Bill 2355 to the fourth, as amended, to the fourth, a due pass with subsequent with referral to Ways and Means. Any more discussion at all? Call the roll, please.
Representative Forsyth?
Yes.
Representative Greenland?
Aye.
Representative Leininger?
Yes.
Representative Post?
No.
Representative Sanchez?
Yes.
Representative Springer?
Yes.
Representative Stark?
Excused.
Representative Vile?
Aye.
Vice Chair Olson?
No.
Vice Chair Williamson?
Yes.
Chair Barker?
Aye. Motion passes. Thank you, committee. We'll stand adjourned. Passes. Thank you, committee. We'll stand adjourned.